Hello, everyone, to the third ACED podcast. So that's Livia, Edu, and Giuseppe. I'm happy to record another session, this time on degrowth and from home, of course. So for everyone who's not familiar with ACED, I will give a quick introduction about the organization itself. So ACED is a local, small grassroots organization in Amsterdam. And we are fighting for social and environmental justice. Our main campaign is about raising awareness about the use of fossil fuels within agriculture and campaigning against those responsible multinational corporations and also uncovering the consequential social impact of those multinational corporations and their actions. And for the time being, ACED decided to talk about degrowth within our collective and the connection to the food system. And for now, I will try to give a short definition of degrowth. But I also want to emphasize that this is like nearly impossible in such a short time and with just a few sentences, as it is such a multi-layered and complex term. But generally, degrowth criticizes continuous economic growth and advocates for different use of energy, distribution of care work, universal basic income, reduced working hours, and at the same time also an increased focus on education, equal access to education in the first place, a better for everyone accessible healthcare system, and overall living in harmony with each other and nature. And all those ground values from the degrowth movement also apply to the same extent for a food system that would represent those values within a degrowth society. And this same idea goes hand in hand with the understanding of food sovereignty. So degrowth and at the same time food sovereignty asks for fair working conditions, the end of exploitation of labor, regenerative local agricultural practices, and all of this under the framework of a caring bottom-up decision-making community advocating for solidarity. And of course there's loads to read about degrowth, so if you want to find out more, then of course now listen to this podcast, and also we can suggest you some readings in the end. And in today's episode, we will go deeper into the general concept of degrowth, Giuseppe's understanding of degrowth, and also the connection to food and nature, as well as degrowth in relation to globalization, and of course, as always these days, in connection to Corona.
Thank you very much, Livia. So first of all, we would like to welcome Giuseppe, which it's in the other end of the line. Ciao Giuseppe, how are you doing? Thanks a lot once more to be with us today.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
That's great. So as Livia said before, I'm gonna start with a quick connection between ACED and Giuseppe and some of the people and students that are working with Giuseppe. We will talk a bit about the Utrecht Degrowth Symposium that they're organizing, and then we will start talking about going to the different questions. So I think it was a couple of years ago, 1 year and a half ago, we saw these five PhD positions from the Utrecht University. It was about transformation to sustainability, grassroots social movement in agriculture. And then we thought that that's exactly what ACED is working on. So we contact Giuseppe in order to start making some connections and to see how their students or these people doing the PhD could connect with us. And then some of the ACED people also went to the first Utrecht Degrowth Symposium. I think it was a bit less than a year ago. And then we start having some connections with other comrades like Isa, Rebecca, or Jacob, which are people who is studying their studies, bachelor's, master's, or PhD with Giuseppe. So that's a bit the connection that ACED has with Giuseppe. Giuseppe is an associate professor of social change for sustainability in the Copernicus Institute of Sustainable Development at Utrecht. Part of their research is focusing on degrowth. So here is the first question. We would like to know, what does degrowth mean for you, Giuseppe? And also, where does your critics on growth start?
Yeah, good point. I think the best way to answer this question is to go back in history, in my history, and briefly, of course. So I started reading about Diderot in the late 90s, early 2000s. These were the times of the first, the World Social Forum, Seattle, Genoa, and so on. And this was also the time when I was essentially doing my bachelor studies in sociology with an orientation towards environmental sociology and environmental studies. And Diderot came to me as a sort of a natural convergence of the ecological economic critique, so the interdisciplinary sort of system-oriented understanding of economy and ecology, post-development studies. So I was reading, thinking of reading lists and suggestions, the work of Wolfgang Sachs, Vandana Shiva, but also Italian activists and scholars working on alternatives to development. So not thinking about alternative development, but alternatives to development. And then, of course, in my studies, the sort of the critique of economy and society as a given. So the idea that, and the recognition that neither the economy or society more broadly are given and exist as, they are constructed, right? And so I ended up doing also a thesis on the voluntary simplicity movement in Italy. And this type of critique has sort of kept rolling. And if you fast forward 15 years or so, then I, as a lecturer at the University of Reading in England, I was doing research on grassroots alternatives to such as transition towns, for example, and alternative food networks. And I was also teaching a bachelor course on essentially perspectives on the economy with a strong component on the growth. And then I moved to the Netherlands and, you already introduced a little bit of what I'm doing in the Netherlands. So I started with five PhDs and other researchers. I have now this project, which looks at whether and how grassroots initiatives in the agri-food system disrupt core elements of capitalism in their attempt to transform towards sustainability. So for me, the connection between my research and the growth is really this how question. How can transformation towards forms of society, which aims at the well-being of all within ecological boundaries, how can this transformation occur? Or in other words, what are the conditions, the prospects, and the mechanisms of such transformation?
Great. That's great. It's even like more clear for us what your opinion and also your research focus. That leads perfectly to the next question. Basically, we would like to ask you. What is exactly the connection between the degrowth movement and nature, food, and agriculture? Okay, what's the perspective, and how we as a society need to change a relation to these three aspects in order to follow kind of the degrowth standards or the degrowth philosophy?
So it's a
tricky one.
Complex question. So one point that we could say is that in a sense, I think, and that's my perspective here, is that the era of food agriculture is under-theorized in degrowth. Okay, so there's some of research, and of course there's a lot of concrete experiences in these areas, experiences sort of initiatives, community, collectives, etc., that go in a certain direction, and I will expand on this. But there's, in a sense, it's not one of the areas that has been theorized most in the growth scholarship. Now, this said, I think it's also important to sort of realize that degrowth is not like a recipe that's a ready-made sort of plan. I see degrowth more as a sort of a, first of all, an analysis of a, of the problems, a compelling analysis of why a society that is sort of compelled to grow forever and exponentially doesn't work. And second, as a compass for moving forward. And this compass, I think, again, it's not prescribed. So we don't have, it's difficult to answer that, your question in this sense, say, okay, what should we do, right? How should we eat? What should we eat? Because I think it's, there isn't one way of doing things. It's more about, again, reorganizing society and economy so that it guarantees the well-being of all and also regenerates life, non-human life, human and non-human life. So in other words, it society that exists within sort of the ecological boundaries. And now where do we see this compass? Where, you know, to make it more concrete. And I think what the research and again, observation and collaboration with people on the ground like yourselves and others really getting their hands dirty, yeah, to experiment different ways of organizing and doing things. I think there we see a convergence around a set of principles. So rather than one single way of doing things, I think more a set of principles that can orient action and visions. So we see in these more grassroots initiatives, principles of sufficiency rather than efficiency, for example, cooperation rather than competition, deep democratic practices rather than sort of more representative democratic practices. And I could continue, you know, the practices that promote regeneration and permanence rather than sort of exploitation, institutions that force a social connection and democratic decision making, again, rather than sort of a top-down imposition of models of food production and consumption. So I think these type of principles, yeah, cooperation, sufficiency, democracy, justice, sovereignty, I think they orient the type of action. Now, if we transfer those to food, yeah, getting closer to your question, the original question, I think this is the type of compass. And again, you can implement in concrete all these principles in when you go to the concrete implementation, you can see these in different, very different forms. And these principles can be and are effectively adapted differently in different contexts. And that's why I say there is no single way to organize. But they are sort of fundamentally, they're very similar. So you I think you would recognize these type of principles in many community supported agriculture projects, food sharing initiatives, in the sovereignty, food sovereignty movement or the agroecology movement. But again, there are many different ways of setting up a CSA, right? Or food sharing initiative and so on. So I think I would look more for, so to answer your question, I think there's this compass, this is sort of set of ingredients that we can draw, yeah, that from the degrowth thinking, the degrowth critique, and that can inform sort of our action and thinking and practice around food and agriculture.
That sounds great. I want to refer to something you said before. Get your hands dirty, because these principles that you're talking about, recently there's this going on, this course from Cityplot, another urban farmers initiative. They're doing this course called Get Down, Get Dirty. So it's literally based on these principles of agroecology, food sovereignty, and especially permaculture. They are doing it's a full year course on Get Down, Get Dirty. It's teaching about soil, teaching about urban farming, teaching about local varieties. So I just want to make this connection between what you're saying. But great, I pass it to Livia, that's gonna talk more about the global degrowth movements.
Yes, thank you. So now we come more, zooming out of the Netherlands and getting more into the global discussion. So we were wondering, what are the potential consequences of a degrowth movement in the global north and the global south? And maybe before we talk about consequences in the first place, is there something like a global degrowth movement?
Yeah, that's another good question. Is there a global degrowth movement? It's yes and no, in the sense that in some countries, and I think of Germany, for example, there's a rather strong sort of social movement that recognizes itself under the banner, if you want, or the label of degrowth. In other countries, it's less so, less the case. But I think on the other end, it's also, I think the again, the critique and the vision and this idea of degrowth resonates with many other movements. And here you see it both in the academic sort of thinking, so the more the scholarship on degrowth, and there's research that has explored the links between degrowth and environmental justice movements, degrowth and climate movements, degrowth and feminist movements, degrowth and commoning, commons movement, and so on. So you see that there, and you see it in practice, where it can exist in a sense formalized ways, but also often more spontaneously, researchers and activists doing, working together with in similar issues that intersect and mobilizing together in different situations, in a more spontaneous, if you want, emergent way. So in a sense, is there a movement that can you clearly label as the degrowth movement? Well, probably not globally, but is there a resonance between the critique and the vision of degrowth and other movements, recent sort of young movements and more long-standing movements that are more, if you want, established and organized? Yes, there's a lot of resonance. Mm. So I see the potential there with of linking degrowth and that critique, that scholarship, to bring, to inform other struggles, and vice versa, of course. Yeah, that's two-way. So if I think of an organization like ACID, many of the things you guys do on fossil-free agriculture and justice and so on, I mean, I see this very much aligned with the thinking around degrowth, and yet you probably don't frame yourself and what you do as degrowth, right? So you see, there's a potential alliance. There's clearly a way of thinking along the same lines and sort of learning from each other, both in terms of intellectual sort of thinking and critiques, and more operational, the more operational level. But what's the boundary between, the food movement and the degrowth movement in this case? It's very blurred. It's a gray area. So
I was personally wondering about that. And also within the collective, we had some discussions around positive and negative impacts of a northern degrowth movement. So on the one hand, people could imagine that it's actually liberating for the global south, as it would cut off the dependency of the global south on the global north. But at the same time, previous economic boycotts have shown that that also means that people potentially lose their jobs, especially in the export industry related to food or fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But then I agree. But on the other hand, these boycotts were implemented in a structure of the economy that, of course, depends on those exports and those, right, and that economic growth to survive. And I think that's really a very important point that about the growth, which is not only about shrinking and reducing consumption, but it's also about reorganizing the economy and society more broadly, so that it doesn't need that growth and that exponential and continued growth to survive. Yeah. So in that sense, I think the growth is not something that is only for the global north. And it's not, sometimes you hear in some of the critiques, of the growth, that the growth is something of a luxury. Of course it emerges in Europe mostly, and it's debated mostly in Western countries where there's a certain level of living and so people can afford to think about reducing consumption, etc. But again, I think that the misinterpretation there is that, or misunderstanding, is that the growth is not only about shrinking GDP or shrinking consumption. It's also about this reorganization so that we can have economies that can guarantee well-being and a good life for all within these ecological boundaries. And if you think it like that, and not as a shrinkage of consumption, then what is so specific about the global north that doesn't apply to the global south, right? You would sort of wish and envision societies that can, in their own way, guarantee the good life within ecological boundaries. And if there is, again, there's no one single way, but there are many different ways of doing that and organizing based on different cultural and other sort of contextual situations. And there's another interesting point, I think, in reflecting about North and South. So many also think of degrowth as a, again, something that emerges in the North and then is transferred to the South, right? Oh yeah, also, you know, everybody has to degrow because we in Europe have decided that this is a good idea. In reality, I see degrowth more as a conversation between the North and the South. So if you look at the history of the thinking, you know, again, development, critical development studies, environmental studies and so on, which has led to really to the current scholarship and practice of degrowth, you will find intellectuals that are European, North Americans, but many, many intellectuals from the global South. So Vandana Shiva, Ashish Kothari from India, Enrique Leff, Eduardo Gudines in Latin America, and many others. Yeah. Again, it's a very, very long list. So it's actually quite an interesting case, I think, degrowth, where there's an interbreeding of ideas. You know, many of these philosophies about the good life that inspire us in Europe actually come from the global South. So the Buen Vivir from Latin America, Ubuntu, and many others from Asia as well. So it's actually much more of an exchange than one might want to depict it. That's what I my message.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the example of Ubuntu and Buen Vivir in the end. Yeah, wow, that was a lot of information. I think I need some time to reflect upon that before I can give a smart counter response. But yeah, thank you so much.
Cool. So thank you again. We will pass to the last highlight of the podcast. Yeah, before I would like to say something. So before I start discussing this point, we would like to clarify that the social and environmental justice demands have not been accomplished at all during Corona times. What I mean with that for us, it's that mainstream media keep talking about the great impacts of that Corona is having on the environment and how the CO2 emissions have been drastically reduced, which is great, actually. But what I want to say is that we understand that this is kind of giving a wrong impression and very superficial understanding on what, yeah, the environmental justice movement is demanding, which is basically, it's more focused on fighting for environmental and social injustice and all the different aspects that you mentioned before. So we just want to clarify on this aspect. It's great that there's less cars, less planes, and we can see clear skies during these days of Corona. But that's not the main fight and the main struggle that we're fighting against. Saying that, we can keep discussing on this while we are asking some questions about the Corona times and the link with degrowth. But saying that, so the question is more about how can we make the theory of degrowth or like the degrowth movement more popular in the climate movement? And also especially now that everyone can see, yeah, the positive impacts of this downscaling economy on the carbon emissions.
Yeah, let me say that I fully agree with you. I mean, what we are seeing now is not degrowth or not the type of downsizing of the economy that degrowth would envision. I mean, this is what is happening is call it a crisis, call it an emergency, in a system that is needs that constant expansion to survive. So if the system is designed like that, then when you have a crisis like COVID and the pandemic and all the lockdowns that follow, then you start having unemployment, you start have poverty and increased vulnerability in various social groups and so on. And that's clearly not what the growth is about. The growth is about planning for a different society. Again, not shocking and shrinking the economy per se, but reorganizing society so that it doesn't need that constant expansion to survive. And that's definitely what we're not seeing. And also this crisis is hitting the most vulnerable and is really showing the inequalities, you know, between those who have spaces at home and those who don't, those who keep the job and those who don't, and so on. And this again is this type of inequalities that are actually highlighted in a crisis like this are the ones that would be targeted by the growth, so would be mitigated by the growth. So just two reasons more to strengthen your point earlier, so that this is not the growth. What the situation is sort of helping us see perhaps is that we can do without some of the consumption that we we were used to, right? And so some people are questioning normality. So you hear this, you know, these different slogans, you know, don't want to go back to normal because normality because normality was the problem. At the same time, you have those who say, oh, we want to go back to normal or to a new normal or whatever. So, but I think, so my point is that there's some sort of interesting reconsideration of what normality might mean or what, you know, what is normal life. Yeah. And I don't want, again, to overemphasize that because a lot of people do want to go back to the pre-COVID normal without any sort of critique or reflection about that. But I think that's one element which is interesting, which is valid for the growth as well as for the climate movement. So, you know, the climate is bringing, you know, climate movement wants change, right? Which is essentially, I see that as a way to challenging what is considered to be normal. And again, in terms of transport, in terms of consumption, in terms of, you know, flying around the world, right? We've come to become, you've become accustomed to flying, right? We as a society, flying a lot and consuming all sorts of highly sort of polluting goods. And I think this challenging of normality is a common point and between the growth and the climate movement, and there's COVID in a sense is a trigger to rethink normality. There's also another point which is I think very valid for both movements, if you want, and a way to tie the two movements together, is that we've seen the state jump in and suddenly being able to intervene in society with regulation, planning, new norms, and of course shaking up budgets and making investments and so on. And definitely not in your lifetime, not in mine, which is a little bit longer, and not probably even in the lifetime of my parents, which is even longer, we have ever seen the state playing such an interventionist role in our economies. If anything, we were seeing a withdrawal of the state from the provision of public goods and services. And this is something really interesting. Yeah. So we again, one of the typical critiques against the climate movement is that, well, you cannot really intervene in the economy, right? The state has to leave free hands to companies, to markets, etc. And if there's any intervention in to reduce greenhouse gas emission, this is through market mechanisms, right? And as something that cannot be touched. And in reality, we've seen that these things can be touched. They are not a given. They are, and going back to my earlier point, these are stuff that we construct, the society construct, and we make the rules. And if we can change those rules, and the state can have that role. And again, this is important for the type of policies that go towards big growth, but also for, and that's essentially, it's really a parallel, for the type of policy that would need be needed, and intervention that would be needed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, for in terms of climate. There's, I think, I was thinking about this, there's sort of a cautionary note to this, because in a sense we are, so we are seeing this, and we are also seeing that people accept it. Yeah, a lot of citizens accept this level of intervention, in our lives, intervention by the state. And I wonder, because if that's because COVID is temporary, and if seen as temporary, so both the state sees itself as being able to do that, and citizens and also companies largely sort of accept that, because it's anyways, it's temporary, it's going to finish, and things will go back to that normal, to the pre-COVID. And when we think about climate, when you think about degrowth, we're not thinking about a temporary change or a temporary, shift in priorities. No, we're thinking of a permanent one. And this is makes me think whether how much this experience that we are doing at the moment with COVID and with these changes is transferable to the type of struggles that both the climate movement and the growth sort of are involved in.
Yeah, totally agree. I think one of the main questions is exactly what you're pointing out. Also, like all these great initiatives that we're seeing nowadays of more social cohesion or like neighborhood initiative, which is more related in the sense of commons, or like all together, like doing masks or whatever to see if this will continue also in the future, or is this just an excuse that's happening nowadays, which I'm afraid it is, but that's my personal perspective.
Yeah, we don't know, right? I think it's probably a premise that we would have, at least in my view. I mean, we are still in the thick of COVID. We don't know really. It's too early to draw any lessons.
Yeah,
I think there's too much that still can happen, and too much that still need to be assessed in terms of impacts, dynamics, and everything. But we do see this. No, we do observe these changes, these things happen, more solidarity and more intervention of the state and some sort of critique of normality. Mm-hmm. And in any case, I think even if things went back to normal, I think COVID sets a precedent in a way. Mm-hmm. I think it will be easier for activists in all sorts of sectors, from food movement, climate movement, and any other, they will have a precedent, because they will say, well, if the state could act like that during COVID, why cannot they act along similar lines in the face of climate emergency or in the face of food crisis, etc. And the same you could say for this solidarity. I mean, it's and this emergence of commons and solidarity, care, etc. It happens. And even if a lot of people then disengage from that, they have experienced that now. And it will stick somehow. It's at least it's a reference. It gives a reference that is close in time and that can be built upon. Even if, again, it might fade as we go back to some sort of new normal. But those solidarity networks that, communities that helped each other, or neighbors, etc. Again, it's a bit question mark, but I think at least even if that causes those connections will fade to an extent, but they will stick at least in the memory and in the possibility. They will broaden a little bit the spectrum of what is possible, of the possible. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it creates this common ground of kind of showing the way. And whatever happens afterwards, if they stay or fade away or whatever, at least people got to know that, through cohesion and through solidarity projects, it's kind of possible. That's the positive, very optimistic side of this. Well, we cannot predict the future, but That's great. The next question I was about to ask you, you kind of already answered it, because it was more about reflection on what COVID can teach us about change. That's kind of exactly what you were answering. And unless you want to do any other reflection or say something else about just let me finish. It's more about if you want to do another more reflection about activism and on these times of Corona, or which do you think are the next steps? Because we as ACID, we organize actions and demonstrations, and these times we had to very resiliently quickly adapt and go online and stuff, and somehow it's working. Just we wanted to ask if you have any thought about this before passing to the last questions.
So I think so there were several questions there. I'll answer them all, then you can see what you keep. In terms of how to change or what reflections on change, I think if we take that those points that we discussed earlier, or we just discussed, I think that points us towards our role as activists to push the government in a certain direction. Again, we have seen what the government or the state can do, right? So that's one thing to make change happen. The other one is to struggle to keep these solidarity networks in place. And the other one is on normality, or this reconsideration of what is normal, right? And what is, And I think that's also some work which is more, if you want, cultural work, which can still be pushed as well. So it might be three areas where, if you want, very early lessons from, or at least reflections from our experience at the moment with COVID. And in how change could be pushed, or at least the three leverages, if you want, or leverage points for that. And perhaps this links also to your question on activism. Perhaps your best place to answer that question than myself. But what I've definitely noticed is that a lot of the activism that was occurring before COVID, so the Fridays for Future and a lot around climate, but also some other civic movements in Italy, where I come from originally, they have stopped because you cannot assembly, you cannot go, you know, to the streets, and this has been, I think, a big big barrier for activists, at least as I see it. The online, what I've seen more on the interface between academia and activism is the proliferation of webinars and open conferences. Because there were a lot of conferences that were supposed to be behind doors, you know, you have to pay and to attend them, and you have to travel and so on. And now they're all, well, not all, but many of them are online and often for free, which is great in a sense, but it's also a bit of a, it creates, I don't know, a lot of let's put it like this, it makes it difficult to really appreciate what people who are not involved in these networks, we are not already part in this network, how much of this goes outside, so goes beyond the network of those who are already committed in their different roles as activists, academics, and so on. And I find it really difficult. You know, we organized, you mentioned the Utrecht Symposium, so we organized last Friday, you know, the symposium, or actually it's already 10 days ago, but you know, we had a lot of people. We had people from all over the world engaging and participating, which is great. But again, how much of this really has an impact beyond sort of the bubble? I'm not sure. perhaps a protest or an action is in the street and goes to the media that is read by people, you know, everyone. So the conventional media, right? That might have more impact than a lot of activism that is online, but it is accessed only by the people who are already networked, yeah, with those organizations. I don't have, it's just a question for me, really. Or an hypothesis that I have, if you want, that because of the medium and how the medium works, which is through these connections and these homogeneous groups that tend to form online, then perhaps the impact of activists might be reduced. I don't know what you think with your experience. But.
Yeah, I think, if I can talk on the behalf of all my comrades at ACID, we don't know what is more effective. If going all online, which is more accessible for people, you can maybe reach more people, not only in the Netherlands or Central Europe, you can reach other continents, which is definitely very positive. And from the other side, I have to say that we miss a lot of action camps. Last summer, it was the year with more action camps in Europe. I think it was around 30 of them, and that's the perfect place for protesting, for connecting with other organizations, and for showing resistance. So basically we're missing this part, which is more the social interaction, and yeah, it's kind of difficult. It's like more my personal perspective. No, Livia can answer from her perspective, but I think it's much more effective this than going online. So maybe in the future, combining this, we can be more stronger. But yeah, I think it's a tricky question that definitely I don't have the answer what is better. But it's true that, like, not having the right to demonstrate, not having the right to assemble in bigger groups outside, it's a big stone, or like a big block in the road, because the momentum of the climate social activism, it is such a big movement, good moment. So yeah, I don't know if you want to share, Livia, on this.
I think we are running out of time. So.
We would need another podcast to discuss about the effectiveness.
And also,
but I think it's
related to a lot of things you mentioned with intervention of the state and the obedience of the citizens. I have like 1 million thoughts I'd like to share now. So your answer triggered a lot of thoughts in mine. But yeah, I think we need to keep the time in mind, unfortunately. So yeah, shall we close?
Yeah.
Okay. sorry, that was a bit sharp now. But yeah, thank you so much for joining this podcast and being our guest. I really enjoyed it. And thank you to the audience for tuning in. If you'd like to know more about Degrowth and also ACID, you can follow us on Facebook, of course, and check out our homepage. And also listen to the previous episodes of our podcast if you maybe now in Corona have more time to do these kind of things. And then, of course, yeah, everyone, take care of yourself in these uncertain times. Be gentle to yourself. And yeah, see you for the next episode.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.